Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Stars Matter, a recruiting podcast from The Athletic. I'm Mitch Light, joined by Ari Wasserman. Ari, today we've got a guest, Manny Navarro. What did we come up with a nickname for him? Was he just Florida Man? I feel like that's taken. So I don't, we kind of need a name for him. Ari, any suggestions?
Sexy works.
Okay.
Sexy Florida.
My wife calls me all the time.
Yeah. I mean, hey, if you, Manny, I would say if you got it, flaunt it. So there we go.
Hot Florida summers that help him shed the weight around the face too, because he's got a nice chiseled jaw because of all that sweating.
All right, I think this is turning into a different. This is turning into a different podcast.
In Dallas, you have to
podcast.
Pay like $50 a month for a sauna pass. In Florida, it's free and no income tax.
Just open your car door and let the heat hit you, and you'll lose 10 pounds.
Yeah. So good show today. We're going to talk to Manny. Just recruiting in the state of Florida. He did a recruiting mailbag a few weeks ago, just on recruiting the state of Florida, the big three there. You, I guess, is it a big four soon? I don't know. We'll have to talk to Manny about it. If it's going to be a big four soon, then you got USF. Him and Manny and Grace put together a recruiting confidential, an ACC recruiting confidential in two parts that was out yesterday, and that'd be Tuesday and Wednesday. Some good stuff there. And we're going to talk Cormani McClain all going on there, probably touch on Jaden Rashada. There's actually some commitments in the 2024 class. Some things are happening there. So, Manny,
have to talk about how Georgia has six top 100 players committed already in 2024.
Okay. We just did. So off to a good start.
But Manny, can we start it with Cormani McClain? Because I'm fascinated by this.
Sure.
Mitch, I didn't mean to hijack you there.
That's exactly what I was going to say. But go ahead. I would have been a little more eloquent than you, but that's good enough. Go ahead, Manny.
Well, I don't know where you guys want me to start with him, other than the fact that obviously he's pretty good at lying on Instagram and telling people he's in Tampa when he's really in Colorado, taking an official visit with Dion. Look, I first really got to know Cormani back in March. I drove up to Lakeland High School when Mario Cristobal was actually going to go give a speech at his team awards banquet. For obvious reasons, Mario's a smart guy, right? Take advantage of the situation to try to recruit a guy.
Saying he knew that Cormani McClain was on the there?
Yes, yes. He had a good feeling he was going after Cormani. And so anyway, to make a long story short, like, he was always sort of guarded. Like, his mom was always sort of involved in the picture, in the sense of she didn't really want him doing interviews. And so I got a chance to talk to him maybe for 5 minutes on my own. His mom saw I was interviewing him. Next thing I know, she's there and just kind of like protecting him a little bit. Like, hey, you know, we're filming a documentary. She tells me he's really not doing interviews. And so I knew, like, this is going to be one of those circus recruitments, right? Like, there's going to be some wild twists and turns. And so for a long time, I think the feeling was, because Lakeland High School, where it's located, the Pouncey twins, if you remember them, of course, both played in the NFL, Mike and
were they good?
Yeah, they were all right. They weren't bad. and so they have a big influence. They're both Florida Gators. And the feeling was, okay, this is Gator country. He's going to end up being with the Gators. And then, of course, in October, commits to Miami. Everybody's sort of shocked. Okay, this has to do with Ruiz, NIL, right? That's why he's picking Miami. This is why Miami's getting the number two recruit. Well, long story short now, he you know, commits to Miami. We go through signing day. Nothing happens. He doesn't sign. And we're all just kind of baffled, because at the state championship game, he's holding up the U. He's doing the whole taking pictures, selling it like it's going to be a hurricane. And now it's just become this big mystery. And I think the feeling from Miami side of it is he's going to flip to Colorado. That's where he's going to end up. Alabama was in the picture for a little while. Then they got Desmond Ricks to jump on board with their class on signing day, or the day after signing day. At this point, I think most people around Miami think he's going to end up in Colorado, but we're not 100% sure. Who knows what's going to happen here? I just think the prevailing feeling is it's Colorado.
Now, I think I read somewhere you wrote, in one of your many Carmoni McClain pieces, while this is clearly a five-star guy, and I think he's number two in the composite, that there's mm-hmm. some thinking there that he is not a immediate plug and play as a freshman, which is always difficult for a cornerback. Is that an accurate assessment, or am I interpreting things incorrectly there?
Yeah, I think he's a guy that has to put on weight. I mean, he's about 6'2", 170 pounds. He probably needs another 10 pounds to really, you know, go out there and be a full-time starter for you, to take the kind of hits and stuff that he's going to take at the college level, playing against guys that are his size or bigger. But he's obviously a talent. I mean, having watched him on the 7-on-7 circuit when he was going up against other elite kids nationally, there were times he got exposed. He was trying to kind of bait the quarterbacks into throwing the ball towards him so he can intercept it. And instead, he was getting beat over the top. And it happened quite a bit. So to me, he looked like a guy that when he gets to college, he's going to need to kind of be coached up a little bit and put, you know, given some time to put on weight. But, you know, without a doubt, he's an NFL prospect, a guy that you would think would end up playing on Sundays.
Ari, this is kind of what we thought when Deion took over, that we thought he was going to start flipping guys left and right. And he did the Dylan Edwards flip, which, as you reported, there was history there. He knew the family. So this is really to me, Deion's done a lot of good things, but this is the one that really announces what he can get done there.
Yeah, the thing that I think is interesting is that when McClain committed to Miami, like you said, Manny, that people assumed that there was NIL involved, right? And let's be honest, there probably was or is, right? Is the power of Deion Sanders, because I can't imagine that Colorado can get the money together the same way Miami could. Mm-hmm. Is the Deion Sanders factor at Colorado enough to outweigh the financial benefits of playing at a place in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately here, it's the complete package, right? Like I mentioned earlier, Cormani's mom mentioning how they were having a, you know, sort of filming a documentary of Cormani or whatever and following him around. Deion obviously is doing that with Amazon, right? With Prime, he just put out those videos, that four video segment on Prime. And, you know, I think maybe the thought process is if you come play with Deion, you're going to kind of get the TV exposure, the national exposure that you want to help your branding, et cetera. So I think in that regard, that's where Colorado probably has the advantage. I don't think Mario Cristobal is going to be cool with anybody following McClain around Coral Gables and filming everything and putting that online. He's very secretive, obviously. So I think that's the advantage. In the end, you know, where the money comes from and how they get it to him, I don't know. I would assume that a guy like Cormani is going to make money no matter where he goes. And without question, I think NIL plays a factor in all this.
That's an interesting discussion, Mitch, and I'll get your take on this. But, you know, we always talk about Alabama and Georgia and Ohio State and Clemson and some of these big-time programs that, you know, have things to offer outside of just financial inducement, right? You know, the ability to come in and play for national championships. You have a track record of development. We've talked about that ad nauseum.
I'm going to steal from your mailbag today. I thought you phrased it perfectly, Ari, about those schools like that might be able to give you things that you can't deposit immediately in your checking account.
That's right. But I think that Colorado one is a really good example of it. It's like in the world of NIL, exposure, being a personality, branding is all very important. Now, that might not be a direct deposit the day you sign, but if you believe in your ability as a player and, you know, your opportunity of being on YouTube and all that stuff has a chance to help your brand, I think that's a very interesting way to look at it. And I thought about this a lot with Travis Hunter. Like when Travis Hunter went to Jackson State, you know, we didn't really watch him play that much because he was at Jackson State and it wasn't, you know, the typical Power Five or big time group of five games that we watch on TV on Thursday through Saturday and sometimes Sunday. But then once he decided to enter the transfer portal, he had a brilliant idea to say, I'm going to announce my decision when my YouTube channel gets up to 100,000 subscribers. And I thought that was brilliant because I went online and I looked, if you have 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, I think that's in between $6,000 and $8,000 a month, you know, and when you look at just the ability to brand yourself that way, you know, taking it into your own hands and making money legally and doing things that, you know, aren't reliant on, you know, collectives and NIL people who, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into the Jaden Rashada discussion again, might not pay or be about what they say they're about when they're recruiting you. So that to me is a very interesting aspect to this whole thing, is betting on yourself and going to a place that, you know, doesn't have a proven head coach in terms of winning, but has a brand juggernaut that can get you on Amazon Prime and might, you know, put you in a better position to be a more marketable player.
Yeah, I think that's all accurate and kind of what, again, you touched on in your mailbag. All right, this is sort of related to that. While you made the point that while if you look at the top two teams in the recruiting rankings this year, Alabama and Georgia, sure, they're involved in the NIL space, but they're probably not the two schools that paid the most as quote-unquote inducements, is because kids go there for other reasons, namely to win a national championship and to develop into a draft pick. We don't need to revisit last week's discussion about recruiting versus developing draft picks, but I do think the Cormani, if it is in fact Colorado, this is fascinating.
Because Colorado is unparalleled in that regard. There's no other program in the country that will get you that much FaceTime or encourage you to do those types of things digitally in terms of social media platforms and, you know, YouTube live videos and all the things that these guys can do, because there's such a market for, you know, content and streaming and eyeballs that, you know, the thing too is like anybody who transfers could have done what he did. You know, 5-star player from Georgia who said, you know what, when my YouTube channel gets 100,000 views, I'll announce where I'm going, could do the same thing, but it's encouraged there. And, you know, I think
they're
it's
gonna
funny.
They're going to get prime TV spots too next year. They're going to be on ABC Saturday. If, you know, I don't.
Now, you better be good.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like if they stink, then it won't be, because I do think that there is one aspect that nobody said, but I've thought is if Deion goes there and for 2 years are not very good, like it's going to wear off. You know, it's the same thing like with a Will Ferrell movie. He made a lot of really awesome movies, Wedding Crashers and, you know, Old School and all that. But after 5 or 6 years of making the same type of movies, they stopped making them because we kind of got the picture. So, you know, as long as Deion Sanders is entertaining right now, that's great. But I also think too, at a certain point, that, you know, to steal from a Wolf of Wall Street, the chickens are going to come home to roost. And if they're not winning games, then it's going to be less interesting to consume. So, but Manny, I wanted to say, it isn't surprising at all that the first NIL holdout or NIL going off the rails is in the state of Florida, is it?
Not at all, man. That's what we're known for, right? That's what we do here in Florida. We screw things up. In all seriousness, this whole Jaden Rashada mess is just it is so Florida. It really is. And just from talking to Alan Taylor, who I think has done a phenomenal job with this story, is just how basically Florida and the people around the program have admitted they screwed up, right? Like this essentially is them saying like, yeah, we made a bad deal with the recruit, our collective did. And now we got to deal with the consequences. And who knows what the next chapter is, if this is going to end up in litigation. I would assume it probably will. But it's just wild that, you know, Rashada, again, another guy that I was sort of following early on from, you know, Mitch knows this, from me going on a couple of these 7-on-7 trips out in Vegas and meeting with him and his father and you know, he's supposed to go to Florida. Next thing you know, he's going to Miami for a visit. He's committed to Miami, flips to the Gators here, where I think he wanted to go all along. And then, of course, you know, signs on the dotted line and they want to take his big contract away. I was just blown away by the fact that it escalated to $13 million. I never imagined in my wildest dreams it would go that high for a kid like Jaden.
Yeah, they go across. Obviously, Cormani McClain's an in-state kid, but they can create, Miami and Florida can create all this drama with a kid from 4,000 miles away, yes, too. So they can do it wherever they want.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Are you anything to add before we move on
I think
Rashada?
It's just an interesting scenario because this is, I think, going to give us a peek into the curtain of something that's going to happen all the time, which is when you're dealing with people who are offering you certain amounts of money that don't even seem rational. Like you just said, Manny, $13 million blows my mind. I just like looked up Aaron Rodgers' base annual salary. And I don't know if that's a correct number, but he is making, I think, $58 million over the course of his contract. And like, that's like almost a quarter of 20% of Aaron Rodgers' deal for a kid that, frankly, I saw at the Elite 11 and had a hard time hitting his targets. And I'm not saying he's not very good. It's just a sobering reminder that these guys aren't developed yet. So when they're not developed, it's a it's a bigger risk than getting a transfer, a guy who has, you know, proof on film. It's just like, this is going to be something that I think happens all the time until we figure out how to, you know, properly regulate it.
I think the story here is the Florida Collective and the Miami Collective fighting, sort of just going all out, right, to win the battle, the public image battle, right? Florida was pissed that Miami was able to get Rashad at a flip. He was going to commit to Florida in June before he took that late visit. And I think this just came down to a bunch of guys running a collective who, you know, this is an ego contest. Who's going to win? And they wanted to beat John Ruiz, and they made this outlandish deal that they knew that they probably weren't going to live up to. And they just had to beat Ruiz at it. And again, that's so Florida, right? This is what we expect.
Well, the question I had for you, Manny, is is there, like, and not that we've seen the contracts here, mm-hmm. but is there a certain expectation that you're not paid until you sign a national letter of intent? And if you're Rashada or a prospect in his position who is offered something, why sign that document? Because it just adds to me a level of another hurdle that doesn't really need to be in place when you can enroll in a school and never sign that document. You know, do you have to sign it to get the money? Is that the way they're set up?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've only seen parts of one contract, and that was the one related to Nico. I don't think there's anything ever written in the language that specifically says, you know, you have to sign a national letter of intent to get paid. I don't know that that's necessarily declared, because I don't know what's legal and what's not. You know,
it's all a gray area. Yeah,
it's all such a gray area. But I do know that ultimately the way these contracts are written, and from talking to John Ruiz myself a couple of times about this subject, ultimately it's about, once they're on campus, what the amount of hours that they have to put into whatever the deal is, whether it's community service work, whether it's signing autographs. So everything is written into them not making money until they're on campus representing the university and participating in these events as somebody representing the university.
But so why did the problem happen right at signing day? Like, it seemed like that was the thing, right? He signed his national letter of intent, right, and then he didn't enroll 5 or 6 days later. It's like, do you expect a check to clear the second you get on campus? And maybe so. Maybe you don't know this. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. It's just,
right,
it's kind of a hard thing to wrap my mind around, because it's just like, based on what you just said, I wouldn't sign it. I would just show up. And if I don't get paid what I'm expected, or I don't, the terms of the deal that I understood it didn't happen, then I would just leave and mm-hmm. go somewhere else. And that's the thing that's, I wonder if kids are just going to stop signing them, because it's just another document that they don't have to sign that's going to bind them in a world where the financial promises may or may not be kept.
Right. I mean, ultimately, the NILs have all the power here. They can lie to everybody that they want, right, and say, hey, we're going to pay you this amount of money. And then until the kid shows up on campus, they could try to renegotiate the deal and bring it down. And in this case, the Rashadas were ready to fight that. And I think, you know, ultimately you're right. Why sign the name, image, not the name, image, and likeness, but the NLI, the National Letter of Intent, if guys are going to screw with your money and change what they offer you? But I think in this case, it's kind of like good faith. You have to just believe that that's what you're going to get once you step on campus. And there's really no rules to protect the athletes. I mean,
yeah,
the way everything is running right now, they have to believe that whoever they're signing with is going to come through and deliver. And you know, to this point, Ari, we really haven't seen many publicized. We haven't had a lot of people calling us complaining, saying that we didn't get the check, right? I mean, I haven't come across too many people that have called me and said, "Hey, I'm not getting paid by that collective."
Mitch, the thing that we were just when this whole Rashada thing was going down, we were texting about, I think is fascinating. But according to NCAA rules, and a lot of our listeners like bang their fists against the table when we talk about this stuff, is that you are technically not allowed, according to NCAA rules, enforceable or not, to induce a player financially to come to your school. We all agree with that, right? That's a rule. Isn't this entire situation just admission on both sides that actually occurred there? And like, is it possible to enforce this from an NCAA standpoint? I personally think it isn't, but like, I just wanted to know.
It's possible. I just don't think they will do it. I don't think they'll go down that road. I don't think they will win.
So the rule doesn't exist.
A rule can exist if you don't enforce it. I mean, I don't know. It's
just, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't, the NCAA doesn't want to go into another courtroom, right?
Right.
So
I was, go. I was going to say, and this is nothing, I mean, something we've all thought, but we're doing a college baseball coaches forum where I'm talking to coaches from around the country about various topics. And I ask them about NIL in college baseball. Some interesting answers, but I was talking to one coach this morning on the phone off the record about NIL. And he was just like, what are these programs going to, you know, he's kind of from afar, you know, he knows what's going on in athletic departments. He's like, what are these coaches, what's everyone going to do when these kids aren't, they show up and they can't play and they're in their second year and they're expecting all this money from this collective and the coach doesn't want them around anymore. He says, it's just, it's a recipe for disaster. And we're not at that stage yet because we're
is that
still
year in, three.
Yeah. This is a year three or, you know, we're not, I guess some guys from last signing class are there, but it's really from this class of 2023 is the first year that it's.
And my understanding for the NIL contracts are that they are built in with annual like tiers, right? Where you get paid a certain amount your first year, second year, third year. So maybe that'll help eradicate those issues. But are these players actually signing legal documents that bind them to a contract? And if they are, for their own protection, the same way that you and I and Manny probably sign employment agreements with the Athletic, if they are binding agreements, are they enforceable in the court of law if the collective decides later down the line that they're not going to pay you or you're not worth that money anymore? And like the thing too, it's I find so fascinating is that like if the Rashada thing goes to court, the litigation fees that are going to rack up on something like this, because it is so, it's just like so gray. Like it's like you're going to be spending a lot of money on something that really hasn't, you know, come to pass yet. So, you know, this whole thing is kind of a disaster. And I think this is going to be the first of many as it pertains to it. And I wonder too, what this means for Florida's collective as they try to sign other players when they, you know, they try to go after a guy and then they'll ask him what happened with Jaden Rashada. And they'll be like, we made a bad deal and we didn't pay him. Like what's going to, they might be harder to believe down the line that they're going to pay you if they're recruiting you.
Might no doubt. And we're going to move on in a second and Manny can speak to this probably better than I can, but my guess, Manny, is that the Florida Collective does not have the best reputation in a sea of murkiness that people aren't looking at Florida as a you know, a reputable operation. Their collective is a reputable operation right now. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's beyond fair. I think without question, you know, if you're a 2024 recruit, right, and you're seeing Jaden Rashada go through this, you're wondering, hey, are they actually going to deliver? Now, if I'm that collective, I'm getting as many guys that I do have signed that are getting paid to come out and say, hey, we're making our NIL money, you know, and we're okay. You have to kind of, you know, play the public war, right? And fight back and say, hey, we're making our money from these guys. They do come through with payment. I think ultimately the best way for this Florida collective to operate is just admit we screwed up, right? There's our one time mistake and we're trying to fix things and we still are paying our players. So
you know, when they were talking about the CJ Stroud thing, am I allowed to finish my thought or?
Yes.
Okay. Because everybody on watching this on YouTube can see you going like this to your neck.
Well,
okay.
I mean, how many times do I need to say we need to move on?
Well, I think this is the most interesting topic of the show. So,
okay. Manny, are you ready? Ari's going to share the most interesting topic.
No, I think that this topic we're discussing is the one that people want to know about. There was some rumors that CJ Stroud could potentially return to Ohio State, right? And I went and looked at like what a rookie contract would have been for him in terms of like what he would make in year one and like trying to think like what would Ohio State's collective have to come up with from a package financially to get this done. And I came to the solution that that would be $20 million, right?
Because isn't there a bonus aside from everything?
Yeah, it's so insane what a rookie, especially a top five pick, they'd have to come up with that amount of money. And it got me thinking like, that's so much money. And I don't know if CJ Stroud is worth it. Not that he's not a very good player. And you know, the way he played in the Georgia game might be a nice indication of what kind of pro he's going to be. But like, if you're Florida and it was $13 million, or you're another program like Ohio State that has the collective power potentially in theory to pay an individual player $20 million, I like to think to myself, like, that's a lot of money for inducement. And I feel like you could really make a loaded roster. Like, I mean, even think about it, like 250 grand guaranteed or 500 grand guaranteed probably goes a long way with many of the top 100 players, right? Because I especially don't think that a lot of these contracts or amounts that are being reported are even true. Like, if there was a $20 million surplus of cash that they had laying around for CJ, like, what kind of badass recruiting class they could sign with that money the following year? And to me, I think that would be money better spent to sprinkle around, get a left tackle, get a linebacker, get a safety, get a running back, and, you know, do it that way. So it's just like, to think $13 million, even over the course of a four-year period, for a player who may not even be good, it's just an astronomical amount of money that doesn't even make financial sense to me.
Well, you did that survey, anonymous survey, probably about a year ago or 6 months ago, yeah. Ari, about we're asking staffers, recruiting staffers, how they would allocate money. And that's a good question to ask. If you had $10 million, would you pay it to your known quantity at quarterback to come back for one more year? Or would you disperse it to seven guys, including two, no doubt about it, you know, linemen and a cornerback? I mean it's kind of monopoly money, but it's kind of not monopoly money because it does exist in some places.
Yeah. So. And how long this will continue, I guess, is another discussion.
Yeah. But we will discuss this more. I have a feeling this will not be the last time. You want me to move on, Ari?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you might be scratching your prodigious beard there. We will be speaking about NIL, more to come, I have a feeling. So Manny and Grace put together ACC Recruiting Confidential. If you've been reading The Athletic for the past year and a half, you've listened to us. We've done a series of state recruiting confidentials. Manny partook in the Florida one, which was very interesting. We've done them for a lot of states. We got one coming up on Washington soon that Christian Campbell's putting together. We're going to start doing some conference ones, and Manny and Grace did it. Some good stuff. I want to go over some numbers here, but Manny, my kind of takeaways were that, and they talked to high school coaches from around the ACC footprint that have sent kids to the ACC. So it's not just some high school that, you know, might have sent one kid in the last 5 years. Is that Mario Cristobal recruits like an SEC coach. Dabo Swinney is very well liked and still does things his own way. And everyone else is just trying to catch up to those two. Is that relatively accurate?
Yeah, I think without question, I think for the most part, those two guys are sort of looked at as the gold standard from a recruiting standpoint. Who's going to do the best job recruiting, you know, those particular players from those schools, you know, who's sort of always reachable, who sort of has the best plan. I think those two guys without question. But there were some other coaches who got a lot of credit. You know, I sort of, my favorite question is always related to the assistant coaches.
Yes.
Because I feel like those guys are really the ones that do a bulk of the recruiting. For Mario Cristobal, he's the guy, right? He's the main recruiter for Miami. But for a lot of these other programs, and you know, coming across Florida and speaking to a lot of the Florida coaches, since I'm down here, Pittsburgh, you know, their staff got a whole lot of credit for doing a great job. I think they ended up signing seven kids out of Florida this year. And so to me, I always enjoy that aspect. The other question that I kind of threw in this year, and I think it's part of part two of our two-part segment that we put out, was copycats, right? Like, how many of these coaches actually do their own homework, their own research before they come to their school, or do they just offer off of, you know, what other people are offering? If Alabama comes in or Ohio State comes in, do they just offer a kid automatically? And I would say, based on all the conversations I had, probably 20% of the coaches who come in actually do their own homework and are ready and prepared to talk about kids. You'd be surprised to see how many coaches can't even pronounce the name of some of these players when they come on campus. They don't even, you know, they have no real relationship with them, but they come in and they offer and they want to talk to them. All of that to me fascinates me, the way all this is sort of put together.
Yeah, well, yeah. One thing that I'll let you go in a second, Ari, that I've always found interesting in recruiting is when coaches show up at a school to recruit someone and they say, oh, who's that kid? You know, they see someone else on film. I think that was, we've done so many recruiting stories, Ari, I think it was one of yours. Was it someone where a kid walked by? Yeah, who was it? Where he walked by the office. The coach was waiting for someone else.
Arian Carter.
Yes, he walked. Was that it? He walked by.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, because again, you've done so more.
Oh, no. That was the kid for CJ Donaldson, the running back at West Virginia.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. From Miami. Like, yeah. Yeah. And he didn't have a position. So there's so many great stories like that. And as a tangent, like, I think it was you know, who was it? Wide receiver for Western Kentucky. He played for the Titans for a few years. Jeff Braum found him at Western Kentucky just watching a high school basketball game. I think watching somebody else. And then he jumped out. So there's so many great recruiting stories like that. Go ahead, Ari.
Yeah, I think one of the main questions in your guys' confidential that I thought was most interesting is, you know, it is the Big Ten and the SEC, right? Mm-hmm. In your opinion, you know, if you take away the two that you like, Cristobal and Dabo, like, does the ACC have a chance to be competitive, or are they doomed to be the Big Two and the Big 12, the Big 12 was a little bit ago? You know, I don't know. Is the ACC really going to be hurt by this?
It's hard to say because of the 12-team playoff, right? Like, if they can still sneak two teams into the playoff every year, I think most people would say, okay, the ACC is still a respected conference. I think between Clemson, Florida State, Miami, and maybe North Carolina, when they've got talented quarterbacks like Drake May, you probably have a shot of getting two of those four in, right? Once Mario gets everything going the way he wants to. I mean, Norvell, I think he's sort of proven now that he's pretty good at this transfer portal thing. Most people are expecting Florida State to be good next year. So I think if they can sort of maintain it, the ACC will be respected. Not to the extent the SEC and Big Ten are, but certainly not, I think, embarrassed, which I think a lot of people have maybe looked at the ACC that way and say, oh, it's a trash conference. They're really not a part of this at all. You know, they still have Clemson's national championships. They still have Florida State's, you know, 2013, 2014 title. So I think from the way recruits view the ACC, I think there is some level of respect, but it certainly isn't the first class. I mean, SEC is it. And then I think the big 10. And then after that, it's kind of, well, you know, where are the best coaches at? Where's the most NIL?
Yeah, I think that the perception stuff is interesting, but I also think the more pertinent question is, once the SEC and the Big Ten contract money starts flowing into those schools, whether or not the mm-hmm. ACC will financially be able to keep up.
Yeah, that's. But we're a couple years away from that because we still haven't seen a sizable gap. I think it's going to progress to that, obviously, with the TV contracts as it picks up. But right now, I think it's not that much of a sizable gap. I think where you're going to see it is in the coaching ranks, right? Like who the quality of assistant coaches, the coordinators. The moment you start seeing quality, you know, assistants from Pitt or wherever, the guys that are winning those recruiting battles going to the Big Ten and the SEC because they're making a boatload more money there, I think that's when you'll start to see that difference.
I wonder if it'll ever be a case where the offensive coordinator of Purdue is a better job than the offensive coordinator at Florida State. Is that ever going to happen?
It might be a more well-paid job, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, and then if it's a more well-paid job, that means that better people are going to go and it's going to elevate Purdue. And I just like wonder if in 15 years – you know, and who knows, in 15 years, there might not even be conferences anymore. But like, it's just a crazy thought, really, when you think about how much money it's going to be so lopsided.
Well, you know, this we'll never get to this, but we see where a guy like Sean Lewis leaves a G5 job to be a coordinator at a P5 job. And we've seen FCS coaches, you know, head coaches leave to be position or coordinators. I don't think we'll ever get to that. But
You don't think it's possible that NC State's quarterback or head coach would go be the offensive coordinator at Ohio State?
No, I don't think we'll get to that. But
I think the 12-team playoff is the thing that's the wrinkle that we really don't know, because in the end, these guys are going to want to, right? They want to make the playoff, and there's only so many spots the SEC and Big Ten are going to get. Like if you go to the ACC, you know, you'll have probably a better opportunity, I think, you know, winning that conference than you would going to the SEC where Georgia and Alabama and everybody's loaded up and ready to kill you.
The playoff thing is just interesting to me because, like, Manny, you're right. Everybody wants to make the playoff, but do they want to make it more? They want to get paid?
Yes. Because they're already making a lot of money. They're already making – I mean, Ari and I, Manny, we go back and we have different views on finances to some degree. But mm-hmm. if they're already making a ton of money, I want to be in a position where I can win. The extra X percent more money doesn't influence me, but that's me. Ari, you would always go for the money.
I don't think I would always go for the money. I think I would go for happiness if I reached a certain level of wealth.
And all these guys are. All these guys are compensated. They're all above whatever line it is.
But I think that it's like I was watching the Bernie Madoff thing.
I was too. I keep falling asleep while watching it, but I've been watching it.
And I thought to myself, like, this guy was already so absurdly wealthy before this. Like, why would you possibly do something that would hurt so many people to get money that you couldn't even spend if you wanted to? So like that type of mentality, I think, is just kind of a sickness, you know, to do what he did. But I don't know if the jump from $2 million a year to $7 million a year is quite that. Like, I think like $2 million a year is a hell of a lot of money, you know, and you could live a very comfortable, you know, blessed life making that much money over a 5-year period. If you make $10 million in 5 years, you're probably good for life. But I think that the jump from 2 to 7 is way more significant than you think it is to people.
Yeah, I mean, it's everyone's got their own opinion. 2 to 7's...
2 to 7 a year, a I think, yes. would make somebody leave a job that has an easier path to the playoff. Yeah,
that's not what I was envisioning in my head, but go ahead, Manny.
I was going to say, there's only so many coordinator jobs, right, where you would probably see a difference like that. I think the bigger difference will be wide receivers coach, defensive line coach. Like, it's those guys that it would be a sizable difference in terms of what they're making. Mm-hmm. Whereas the coordinators, again, there's only so many jobs that are available. And then, you know, what ultimately do each of these coaches want to use that job for, right? Nobody wants to be a coordinator forever. They want to eventually move into a head coaching job. The majority of the coaches do, right? They want to move up.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of what's the best place to springboard you. But I get your point. Money will without question affect decisions. I just think it'll probably be more effective at the lower levels. That's where you'll see sizable gaps.
Yeah, and I don't know if Sean Lewis is the greatest example, because he probably figured going to be the offensive coordinator at Colorado and having a great offense will help him get to his ultimate goal of being a Power 5 coach faster than being the head coach at Kent. So that, like, I could see like MAC level. I just hope that we don't get to a point where, you know, we've got 31 teams in two conferences and everybody else can't even manage to compete financially. And it's like, we're talking about salaries of assistants, but what about overall recruiting budgets? I mean, like, think about how much money Georgia's spending, and they have got more talent in their own state than to themselves and any other team has to themselves in their state. And they still spent twice as much as most other teams last year or 2 years ago. And if you have more money for recruiting budget, that means more Lamborghinis on the field, more photo shoots, more travel, you know, more higher end meals. When, you know, it's just like the amount of stuff that you can buy with. I mean, the Big Ten and the SEC is going to have to figure out a way to spend all this money, because there's only so many waterfalls you can put in your athletic building. You know, at a certain point, it's going to have to trickle into salaries and recruiting budget and stuff. And I just wonder if there's going to be a point where it's like you can't financially compete in any regard. And if that happens, then I think we're going to have a real have and have not situation in college football, because it starts from recruiting up.
Yeah, I think the psychology, going back to your Sean Lewis part, the psychology of the whole situation is interesting to me. He was a successful coordinator at Syracuse. I think they won 10 games when he was there. So he's like, Kent State, man, that's a tough job. They got no money there, but I want to be a head coach. I'm going to go be a head coach. So he goes there to be a head coach and does really well, and probably was interested in moving up. But he probably checked the temperature out there, and there wasn't a lot of momentum for P5, high-level P5 programs hiring the Kent State head coach. So then the psychology is, okay, I got to go be a high-profile coordinator again. And Colorado right now under Dion's more high-profile than Syracuse. So it's just like this guy's worked his whole life to be a head coach, becomes a head coach, and is willing to take 2 steps back to maybe take 4 steps forward.
Right.
I was just going to add to Ari's point when he says, what do you do with all this money instead of investing it into waterfalls or whatever on campus? How about just give it to the players, right? Why not just organize and say, hey, we're making the most money. We don't need the NCAA. We want to start paying players and get to the point where we all kind of just grew up with this whole thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just kind of hope that we get to a point one day, and I'm sure you two will agree, that we don't have to sit here and speculate about NIL. Right. I hope that it becomes public information and we can just know the score.
What I would love to see, and sort of piggybacking Manny's point, is because Ari writes about it, we talk about it. Our job on this podcast and writing recruiting has become more difficult because we just don't know who's getting what. Like, let's say the money gets to a certain point and it should be at a percentage. I'm just making this up. 29.7% of the TV deals goes to the 14 teams in your league, and it's dispersed to the players, and then we know what everyone's getting. And then we can reintroduce the bag man, and fans can get pissed off at their fans at the opposing school for cheating again, back in the good old days when there was some real good old fashioned cheating.
Right.
Well, the thing too that's so funny about that is, like, in theory that sounds great, but if you are dispersing television money to the players, then the ACC and the Big 12 and the Pac-12 have zero shot, because the portion of the pie that would be coming from that would be. And then there would be guaranteed money for everybody. And the question I think you have that gets murky too, and this is an age-old conversation, is how do you disperse that SEC TV deal? Like, how much does Bryce Young get, and how much does Tommy Brockermeyer get? You know, like, that's can you do like equal for everybody?
How much
is
the backup safety at Vanderbilt versus the Bryce Young?
Yeah, so. Like, is it going to be the same money? And if so, that would be, you know, that would be tricky too. I mean, the thing about it is that it's like, the NCAA and college football in general has been skirting paying the labor for so long that it, like, puts our minds into a pretzel about how a fair compensation package would even work. Like, is it up to the coaches and the, like, does the school going to have a GM that decides who gets paid more? And like, are you going to have guaranteed contracts from the television money disbursements to the recruits saying you come to our school and we guarantee you'll get X percent of this 29% we're giving out no matter what?
And then you hear and from then, the backup wide receiver's dad, why is my son not getting
like
Ladd
McConkley, for instance, like gets paid half as much as the five-star receiver that didn't catch a pass in the playoff. And he'll be like, what the hell's going on here? And then that could lead to transfers.
Spoiler alert, I think it's happening already, guys.
Yeah, I know. All right, but the TV money, though, money.
Yeah.
So if you think about 29.7%, that's 29.7% of a billion with a B.
A lot of
like,
money.
We're talking about like NFL money now.
All right. So in Manny did amazing research, and Ari, you know I like spreadsheets. I like research. Manny did some research that I got into. I saw a spreadsheet, and I just got intimidated.
Is it the Miami, Florida, or is it the Florida recruiting spreadsheet?
It's the ACC recruit. And Manny, I'm going to do this for the other leagues because I love this chart, and I want it to be in our other recruiting confidentials. But Ari, you don't have this in front of you. I'm sure you saw it. But Manny, from the last six recruiting cycles, went over where kids who signed at ACC schools are coming from. The number one state of producing ACC talent is, Ari, you can probably guess.
But it's Florida.
Yes, Florida, 344 signees. The most have gone to Florida. The second most, Florida State. Number three, Louisville. Interesting. Okay, we won't do this for every state. What state do you think is the second most produced the second most signees to ACC schools over the last six signing classes? This one's easy. It's hard
it
after
is?
That. Yeah. I'll give you a hint. It rhymes with Georgia. Georgia, you're looking at me like I'm an idiot. It's Georgia, of course. Don't you think Georgia would produce? You look seem confused.
Well, I was confused, but you were just telling me the answer. I actually was trying to think of a state in my head that rhymes with Georgia.
I know. I was trying to think of something funny to say, and I couldn't.
But so Georgia makes sense. Yes,
yeah,
that's easy.
297. Georgia Tech with the most. I might not have guessed that. I don't know why. I don't know what I would have guessed, but it makes sense, obviously.
I wouldn't have guessed it. I'll be honest. I thought because Georgia's such an S, but you got to – it's tricky because whenever
these
I'm
are,
thinking –
These are
I'm
ACC
thinking,
signees, so.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about like top-tier talent. It's like, yeah, what about the 9,000 three-stars that came from Georgia that went to the ACC? Yeah.
Clemson second and Louisville is third. The number three state, I won't give you a hint. Can you name it?
North Carolina.
Correct. 214, NC State 1, UNC 2, Duke 3. Virginia is 4th. South Carolina is 5th. Maryland is 6th. New Jersey 7th. Texas 8th. Pennsylvania 9th. Alabama 10th. And notable about Alabama is Clemson is 1st. They've signed 14 kids out of Alabama. A lot of notable guys in that class. So just check this out. This was in part one of the confidential. Part two is today, or Wednesday. A lot of NIL stuff. And Manny, before we move on, the thing that was notable to me about NIL, the high school coaches that it's a mess. They just think it's a mess. And some of them were like, I don't want to be involved, which is kind of noble. Like they want to help their kids and they can help them on. Yeah, this coach he's a stand-up coach. I like this program. They can help them maybe choose the schools for the quote unquote right reasons. And they just don't want to be involved in all the NIL stuff.
Yeah, I think part of that is they don't want to incriminate themselves either, right? Like just in case the NCAA comes calling, hey, who offered what? Yeah. But I think ultimately, not that the NCAA will, right? I don't think that'll ever happen. But at this point, I think a lot of it for these coaches is they have relationships, right? Like the guys have been doing this for a long time. They've gotten to know these college coaches, and they don't want to like tell a kid, hey, pick the school or pick the money over the school. They still want to kind of stick to their guiding principles, which is you want to go play for the best coach, the guy that helps you get to the NFL and develop you and the guys that I trust. And so I think that's why they don't want to get involved in the NIL conversations.
You know what's interesting, and not to hijack this, but
go ahead.
Catherine B, our most loyal listener.
It's a great question today in the mailbag.
Yeah. And I thought it was an interesting discussion. She asked me, Manny, how do you properly evaluate coaches in the NIL era from a recruiting standpoint? Mm-hmm. And the first coach that came to my mind, and I probably should have written more about this in the mailbag, and I didn't, but I guess subconsciously saved it for the podcast, is how do we evaluate the job Billy Napier did? Like, you know, he just signed a class that has, I think, the fourth highest average player ranking in the country. That might still include Rashada, but like they lost Rashada at the end. No five-star prospects. I feel like his evaluation is really difficult.
It is just because of the way things ended. But I told you guys the last time I was on here with you that I thought he did a phenomenal job in terms of just blue chip percentage. Like to me, that's that 17 out of 19, I think, if you don't count Rashada, that's close to 90%. I think Ohio State and I think it's Alabama, the only other two schools that had a percentage that high in terms of their overall recruits. So to me, I thought he did a good job just getting some of the best players out of different areas. Now, I know there's no five stars in there, but he's got DJ Lagway already, you know, hooked up for the following year to replace Rashada.
It's a long year.
Yeah, it is a very long year, and who knows what this Jaden Rashada mess will create down the road in terms of problems. But I still think, you know, to me, he did better than his predecessor. Like, that's my general opinion. I think from talking to a lot of people, coaches and players, I think they like Florida more with him running it than they do Dan Mullen.
Yeah, and Lagway's a stud, too.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can figure out a way to hold on to him, I just thought that it was just an interesting thought because it's like
it is hard.
You know, how do you evaluate coaches that work at programs that have more aggressive NIL inducement approaches versus coaches who work at places that theoretically don't? You know, it's like I thought evaluating Jim Harbaugh was difficult because there's so many other factors. It's like they made the playoff for the first time ever. They beat Ohio State, got there, and then they signed a class the following year that doesn't have a single top 100 player in it. It's like, how do I do that? Because Michigan, theoretically, from what we know or what we've come to understand, is not as aggressive in inducing players. So it's like, did he do a good job? Did he do a bad job? Is it because he flirted with the NFL?
Yeah, some of it's self-inflicted.
Can you write a critical column of Michigan can't maintain this if they are recruiting classes like that? And then they've got the portal. It's like, there's a lot of angles to this now. That, I mean, like a 2 or 3 years ago, Mitch, it used to be like, look at the class. Was it good or not? And now right. It's like so convoluted with different things to consider. And it's like you could actually make the case that considering Michigan's, you know, stature in NIL and the fact that their coach was flirting with the NFL and just got done doing it again, that they signed a really good class with those transfers they brought in. You know, it's just like a year by year basis. It's hard. It's really hard. It's really hard to be critical when you don't know who's behind the eight ball financially and who isn't.
Yep.
Go ahead, I was just going to add, you know, from my, the other piece that I did was another Recruiting Confidential from the Under Armour All-American game. When I talked to those 15 players, all of them who had pretty much already picked a school, look, money's important, but the sense I got from walking away from those conversations was from a lot of these elite kids, they left money on the table to still go play for the best coach. So it's a small sample size. It's only 15 All-Americans from this last cycle.
I found that interesting.
But I still think the best players in the country are going to go to where they can be coached up best and make the NFL versus... Because
it's smart. It's the smart thing to do.
And we saw that from your ACC Recruiting Confidential too. There were no specific examples, but there were several coaches who said, yeah, I had a guy get offered this. He didn't sign there. He stayed committed to the school because he had a better relationship with the coach. So if those kids were being honest to you and these coaches are being honest, I don't know if refreshing is the right word, but it is nice to hear kids.
And it makes you question whether or not a team like Miami can build a playoff, not a playoff, everyone's going into the playoff now, a team that could win a national title doing it the way that they're supposedly doing it.
Yeah,
Manny, can I just ask you point blank, is Miami just throwing cash around? Like, is that your understanding? Like, how much of that is real? How much of that is just kind of rumor? I know that they have Ruiz out there who's kind of more public than some of the other people who are running these collectives. Like, is Miami just throwing cash around?
It's hard for me to tell you, Ari, for sure, because I don't get the sense that they're just signing everybody to million-dollar deals. When you say they're throwing cash around, are they signing guys for $35,000, $40,000, $50,000? You know, some of their lower end recruits, you know, or getting guys to you know, at the bottom of the roster, that kind of money. Sure, I think everybody's making something at Miami, which is why I think collectively they're doing a good job as far as NIL. But I don't think, like, they're not paying Jaden Rashada $13 million to come to Miami. They're not offering him a deal that outlandish.
I meant by that, not to cut you off, but I want to just make sure that you know what I mean. Is Miami one of the more aggressive NIL spenders? like in relation to their competitors. I'm not saying they're throwing 20 million at people, but like, are they, there's a reason why they signed a top five class this year because they have an attractive NIL compensation package.
I think it's a combination of that and the fact that there's a lot of opportunity to come in and play right away because the team stinks. I think that's that more than anything else from talking to a lot of the kids who picked Miami and signed with Miami, the Francis Maui Goas of the world and the guys who could have gone and probably played elsewhere and had successful careers anywhere they went. I think a lot of it is their relationship with Mario and the fact that they can get everything else that they want because of NIL.
Yeah, and he's a great recruiter. He did it. He's done it every stop, too. So it's not like a guy who Ari, who was never known as a great recruiter, come out of nowhere and sign a top five class. So if you would have said, like a lot of things, it's the combination.
I'm just very interested to see if one of these teams in Miami, for right or for wrong, is one of the teams that is kind of, I think if you just polled random fans, who do you think is the most egregious NIL spender? You'd get a lot of Tennessee, you'd get a lot of Miami. There's a certain amount of teams that just kind of have that stigma now, whether that's fair or not. I wonder if one of those teams that has that stigma will win a national championship as a result of more loose spending than other programs, or if this will turn out to be a waste of money.
It's a fascinating question, Ari. I think we got our first taste of it with Texas A&M, right? Right, the number one class in the country, and they went 5-7, and you know, I think behind the scenes, if you put all those kids, you know, and gave them truth serum and said, "Be honest, how did NIL and all these freshmen coming in affect the locker room?" I bet you a lot of the older players would say yes, without question.
And several, more than one of these baseball coaches I talked to, talking about the transfer portal, was like that. You know, what is it going to do to my locker room if I've recruited a guy to play second base and then I bring in the Big 12 player of the year who's a second baseman and bring him in and that guy I recruited is not playing? That can be applicable in any sport. Coaches are very, very concerned about their chemistry in their locker room. Let's take a look at some quarterbacks. You guys mentioned DJ Lagway. So class of 2024 quarterbacks coming off the board, not much movement later, but there are four five-stars in the 2024 class. Two of the four are committed. Dylan Raiola was committed, not committed now.
A lot of Georgia smoke there, though.
Yeah, and Manny has talked to Julian Sayin, a kid from, Carlsbad, California, who's committed to Alabama. We're going to have a story on him probably early next week. Jaden Davis from Charlotte, looks like Michigan, Penn State, Clemson, seen some Tennessee, and then DJ Lagway from Texas committed to Florida. There are seven top 100 quarterbacks. There are 26 right now blue chippers in the composite. 11 are committed. The recent movement was Auburn and Adrian Posse, Florida kid, I believe, right, Manny? Number 187, parted ways, which was interesting. He committed to the previous staff. I don't know enough about him and his skill strength that if it was a Hugh Free, like who parted ways first, so to speak, but it's not like he was a ranked 700. This is a top 200 kid who obviously can play. So he's off the board there. So do you know anything about him, Manny?
Yeah, it's funny. He was actually at another high school at the start of the season, Columbus High School, Mario Cristobal's high school, and then didn't win the starting job, got beat out by somebody else, and then transferred to I think it was Doral Academy, where I think he's at now. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens to him this season. The fact he didn't play a whole lot as a junior probably is going to affect his ranking, I would assume, down the road. But he was a kid that, you know, at least from the rankings perspective, a lot of the guys love his size and speed and strength and all those kind of things. But I don't know if he's really a blue chip four-star prospect by the time these rankings are finalized and he signs with the school.
Ari, you know why we have Manny on the podcast? Because I can just throw out a random Florida quarterback and he tells us all we need to know about him.
Manny knows his stuff, man. I always enjoy having you on, man. I thought that was a tremendous show. I think it was much better that I didn't interrupt everybody.
It was okay.
We have to have Grace on next week so I can show her
some common courtesy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Love you, Grace.
One notable commitment, though, a quarterback. See, Texas got a commitment from Trey Owens, three-star quarterback from Cypress, Texas, 439. And as Manny just alluded to with the Posse, if that's how you pronounce his name, we're going to see a lot of movement, all the kids, but we're going to see a lot of quarterback movement. These kids just finished their junior seasons. They got the camp circuit. We're going to see guys skyrocket, fall, jump, and all that stuff. So take all these rankings right now with a grain of salt. Some notable commitments. Again, I mentioned there was kind of a lull where there weren't many commitments after the early signing period. Penn State gets a line. This just sounds like a Penn State guy. His name's Anthony Speca, linebacker from Pittsburgh. Kid was put on earth to play at Penn State. Number 328. Rutgers, Gabriel Winowith, athlete from Michigan. Is that his younger brother? His brother played at Michigan, right?
Same Chase? Last name.
Chase. Yeah. I don't know if Winovich. It's his brother, but how many kids with that name, you know, from Michigan, but I guess I could have looked that up.
Probably more than two.
Yeah. Clemson, tight end from Illinois, Christian Bettencourt, number 102 overall. Georgia, Ari mentioned, what is it? How many top 100 kids they have already?
Six.
Jalen Howard, a safety from Florida, number 34. Texas Tech, it's a four-star running back from Houston. Johan Gardenas, number 284. Your Arizona Wildcats on the board with Jordan Washington, a running back from Long Beach, number 137. Were you involved in that financial transaction, Ari, as an Arizona alum?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a
I
say this on the show, and I've said it a million times. I'm going to say it a million and one. If I were rich, like buku dollars rich,
yeah,
the last thing on earth I would do is spend it on supporting a football team or paying a teenager.
Soon you'll be in about 10 years, 12, 13 years, Ari, you will be supporting a teenager.
So here's the thing that's so funny, and I don't know if I'm talking out of turn here, but who's the guy's name that in Miami that had the boat and all the recruiting violations? Nevin Shapiro?
Yeah. Yes.
Like, I think he got like 85% of that right. He had the boat. He had all the fun on the boat. Like, just there's no reason to bring Miami football players on the boat. It's your boat. Just do your thing on the boat.
That's like, what interested him.
Yeah.
Fandom makes you do stupid things.
Yeah. No, I would have just, I would have had the boat to myself. And I just would have enjoyed my life, and I wouldn't have roped Miami football into it. But, you know, hey, everybody's got their own passions, I guess.
All right, I got a, speaking of passions, I got a question for Manny. Because Manny is, I just started working more closely with Manny. I'm his editor now. Are you, and I can tell by Twitter.
Is he annoying as to you as he is to me?
Are you, Manny is not annoying.
Not so far.
Yeah. We can also turn that around.
Does he text you your errors while editing?
He doesn't make errors.
Okay.
We can turn this around too. Are you clearly a Dolphins fan, right?
Yeah, born and raised in the city.
Yeah, okay. So like are you like thrown, I mean, I'm sure you're proud of the team, pleased the team. Like when you're watching a big game, are you like just clear out, I need to focus 100%? Are you throwing stuff at the TV like in a playoff game? What's your fandom like?
Well, I mean, listen, I'll tune into the games, but I really like, I had to like cool it. Like after Dan Marino retired, I was such a big Dan Marino fan growing up as a kid. And then I got into this business and it just became like, okay, you got to be professional and separate. Right. And I almost became a Dolphins beat writer for the Miami Herald about 10 years ago. So I had to kind of like separate. So I'll watch the game, but I've gotten into fantasy football so much that it sort of has replaced my fandom. Like I still root for the Dolphins, but it's one of these things where like, I didn't even watch a playoff game this past weekend, like every single play, because I had a feeling they were going to lose to Buffalo. I didn't want to get upset.
A feeling they were going to lose to the best team in the NFL? Wow, you're smart.
That's why you tune into this podcast for inside.
Exactly.
Inside it is them. Funny. Cause as you get older, because that's the same thing with me. Like as you get older, you replace like childhood like fandom, like a lot of people do, with like gambling and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just kind of fun that way. It's like I grew up a Cleveland Browns fan, and I would bet on the Steelers and paint my face black and yellow right now if I had money on it. You know, like I just have no connection, because I think that's what this business does. Like it,
yeah.
You know, we're just, it's hard to root, like have like the genuine feeling of like euphoria that a fan does when you do this for a living, because like you understand how it works and the business side of it, and you see it every day, and it's like you can't just sit down in front of the TV and go, yeah, the Phoenix Suns won today, you know, like it's just not there for me anymore, like the lights out for me. But the Dolphins are pretty cool. They've got a good, I mean, I think they would have won the game if Tua played.
Yeah, they probably would have. The problem is I don't know if Tua's ever going to play again with unfortunate concussions. Yeah.
All right. He's never going to play again?
Well,
I'm worried. He might not.
Three concussions in 1 year. I mean, I think he will play again, but that's not.
Oh, I didn't know if that was a discussion point or something.
Okay. All right. We got to do trivia. You ready for trivia?
I've been killing it. I feel I've got a
Miami question.
Oh.
And then I've got one specifically for Ari.
Is right. The Miami question, who are the top 10 highest rated players Miami's ever signed in the history of the program?
No, I probably did that last time when he was here.
Okay.
It's the, he needs to rank the roster from 86, 1 to 86 based on how much NIL money they're getting. Because I'm privy to this information. So I have it. So we're going to see. I've got the contracts now. All right, Manny, ready?
Yep.
In 2008, Miami signed the number one class in the nation. They had nine top 100 players in the 2008 class. How many can you name?
Oof. Most of them were from Miami Northwestern, so I should be able to remember this. Probably, I would say at least five or six.
Okay, name them.
Aldarius Johnson.
Yes, he was fourth.
Ja'Cory Harris, quarterback.
No.
He was not there. Sean Spence, linebacker.
Yes.
Marcus Forston, defensive tackle.
Yes.
Brandon Washington, offensive lineman?
Nope.
Okay.
Might have been. I don't have the class. I just have the top 100 guys in front of me, so I don't.
Okay.
You're missing the number one guy. He was not in state.
Ja'Cory Harris was Arthur, in that class, though.
Yeah, he was. Arthur Brown, linebacker?
Yes.
Who else?
You have five more guys.
Wow. Four. Arthur Brown, linebacker, cornerback. I'm going through the roster in my head. So long ago.
Yeah.
Was Greg Cooper part of that class? Running back?
No. Not a top 100 guy.
Okay. Yeah, those are the four I know off the top of my head.
Brandon Harris, cornerback.
Greg, cornerback. I should have known that one.
Ramon Buchanan.
Mm-hmm.
Linebacker. Outside linebacker. Jordan Futch.
Yep, linebacker.
Davon Johnson.
Receiver.
And Marcus Robinson.
Yep, defensive end linebacker.
There we go. Okay, Ari, this one's tough.
I was going to look at that class, and looked at it while you asked Manny, and I couldn't remember any of those.
Yeah, I was working at Athlon, then I was working in the college football world. I mean, I remember those names, but not a lot of...
I thought that was that might have been the Chantrell Henderson class, but was that 09?
That was 09, right?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. That same year, Ari, 2008.
Oh, boy.
Arizona signed the number 27 class, which was, at the time, the program's best of the modern era, until Jed Fish came in. Last year, 22 class in 2022. Arizona signed five blue chippers in that.
In 2008?
Yeah, 2008 class. How many can you name?
Buddy, I couldn't name a single one. I was in high school. I could actually name one because I can remember back to the good players that were on the team.
Yeah, I mean, you lived in the state.
When them for the student newspaper, and I remember that Robert Golden was a really high prospect.
There you go.
He was in the 08 class.
He was 08. He was a cornerback, number 120 overall.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. The other one was
no shot.
I'm going to botch his name. Apiata Tihualamaka.
Tihualamaka.
Okay. Solomon Keller, defensive tackle, 169. Then Jamarcus Webb was a junior college transfer, but he had a rating of a blue chipper. And then Matt Scott, I remember him, the quarterback, number 261. So I wanted you to be involved because the question was steered to Manny. I didn't want to leave you out, Ari.
Well, I appreciate that, but I had no shot of that one.
I know you guys want to wrap this up, and I want you to be able to do that. But I got it. Since I'm such a fan of the show, I want to actually ask Mitch a trivia question, if that's cool.
Okay.
Can I put Mitch on the spot? Is that all right?
I'm happy you did that.
Yeah. All right. All right, Mitch. How many of the 34 five-star recruits in the 2022 cycle started games as true freshmen?
Ooh.
Did you look that up yourself, Manny?
He's doing a story on it.
I did.
Oh, he's doing a story on it. Right.
Yeah.
I thought he just did that only for the show. I was gonna
if
like,
you
damn,
would have
dude.
Looked in our new recruiting Slack channel, you would have seen that he's doing a story on
it. I haven't looked at any of that.
Thank you. How many started a game?
As a true freshman.
I feel like Ari here because I'm going to say something. I'm going to be so off. 21.
Good guess. Not too far off. 15. 15 of the 34 started games as true freshmen. Eight of them started six games or more. Can you name the eight?
The five star freshman from the 2022 cycle?
Yes. This either of you guys, you can tag team this.
I'm gonna let Mitch go first and then I'll try to chime in if I can remember correctly.
I'm drawing such a blank on everyone in that class from the 2022, so they were freshmen this year. I can't even remember.
There's one really obvious one, and we said his name on this podcast.
Who is it?
Travis Hunter.
Yeah.
Yep. Does that count?
Yep, yeah, that's one of the eight.
Luther Burden.
That's another one.
Good one.
Cade Klubnik. Does that count? Because he started the Rose Bowl or the bowl game?
Well, these are guys who started at least six games. So these guys are only legitimate. Six games. Yeah, only eight guys started half of their team's games.
Harold Perkins.
That's another good one. Yep. Great player.
All right. You're dominating.
Did Devon Campbell for Texas start?
No, did not.
What's the other lineman that started for them?
It was Kelvin Banks. So that's okay, four Kelvin out of the eight.
Banks.
Yeah, he was the left tackle.
Evan Stewart.
Correct.
Did Williams at Georgia?
Who's that?
Was it Michael Williams to Georgia?
He actually didn't start. He came off the bench. He played a lot.
He was good.
Right. He only started, I think, two games, but he was in the rotation, heavily involved.
A&M had a few, though, right? Like, did Connor Wegman get the six? No, he only had three, right?
He had four.
What about Denver Harris?
Did not, because he was...
he got kicked off the team.
Right.
CJ Hicks didn't play much, did he, Ari?
No.
Special teams only. Well, you want me to give you the answers,
yeah,
the other guys?
Yeah, I've got a 2:30 meeting, so...
And unfortunately, it wasn't Drew Aller, right?
Yeah.
No.
If Ari was in charge, it would have been Drew Aller.
It was Shamar Stewart from Texas A&M. He started six games. Malachi Starks, the safety of Georgia, who started all of them.
God, we should have gotten Starks. That one was easy.
And then Nick Singleton, the running back at Penn State. He ended up starting eight games.
Wow.
So 1,000-yard back. So actually, compare, and I'll just add this little line here. Compared to the 2021 cycle, because I did look this up, they had 35 5-stars. You only had 13 of the 35 starts. So two more this year in terms of true freshmen, in terms of, I just like doing these kind of things because it shows you the impact, right? Like how quickly do guys step on the field? We always worry about these 5-stars and where they go. How quickly can they make an impact? I find that interesting.
It is.
Yep. Good stuff, Manny. Really appreciate you coming on. It will make it more frequent guest. We'll come up with an official name. It won't be Florida Man. It might not be Sexy Florida Man. We need to workshop that a little bit more. But Ari, you want to do your thing?
Thank you so much for listening to the latest edition of Stars Matter. Manny, thank you so much for being on the show, and we'll catch you guys next week.